I want to get a sense first of your background. How far back does your interest in mathematics go, or mathematical things?
Oh, so that, I'm going to change the question a little bit. I'm going to change it to, how far back does your interest in logical structures go?
Okay.
And they're related. So I think my initial introductions to mathematics, I didn't think of as mathematics. Mm. My father was an electrical engineer and early computer scientist, and before that, ham radio operator, just to give you the idea of the type of person I was growing up with. And he would say things to me like, let's, you know, these seven pennies. How can we arrange them? And we'd arrange them, and we'd sort of get them into this tight flower shape. And my father would say, "Well, that's called a close packing number," something like. And he would start to sort of introduce these little definitions to me, not because he was necessarily trying to teach me the definitions, but just how to see the world in a more structured or more logical way. I remember he had a subscription to Scientific American the whole time we were growing up. And once in a while, he would pull, like, we'd talk about articles in there and sort of different concepts that he'd see. And so that was something, I think that was my first introduction, was actually through my dad. And I remember it must have been grade one or grade two, maybe kindergarten, I don't remember, where, you know, kids are trying to one-up each other, and they're like, I have 10, I have 11, I have 12. And some kid came out with, I have infinity. And I was like, what's infinity? And I asked them, what's infinity? And they said, well, that's a number bigger than any other number. And I said, what? And I remember coming home and asking my dad about what this was. And this was, and he explained the concept to me, and he explained that infinity can also be small and have, go in different directions. It wasn't just, you know, monotonic in one direction. And so I think that's where my first introduction to sort of thinking about the world as sort of abstracted structures and generalizations rather than, things that are just sort of happening to you or stories or whatnot, which are all important. And to me, that's where how mathematics entered my life, because that's how I saw it as important in being able to explain and represent these structures. And so, I actually don't consider myself a mathematician, but I would consider myself a statistician, and they're close. But to me, the statistician is really being able to use those mathematical structures in a way to solve problems that I'm interested in, and it really does kind of build on all that stuff that I don't. Maybe things would have turned out the same if my dad hadn't introduced me to that stuff. But those were my first exposures.
Where did you grow up?
I was born in Ohio. Which doesn't give the right impression. So, because I only lived there till I was about four. So, my mother's English and my father's Australian. My father and mother actually moved from Australia when my mom was pregnant with me, and they moved to Ohio, where he was promoted to the headquarters of NCR and National Cash Register, which was a big computer company back in those days. Yeah. Mainframe days, and so I happened to be born in Dayton, Ohio, which is where NCR was headquartered. But they moved to Canada when I was about four, my brother and I. And so I would say probably the one word answer to your question is I grew up in Canada, so I lived in mostly in Ontario until I was 23 when I went to grad school at Stanford. Well, I moved to Stanford then went to grad school at Stanford.
So your schooling was mainly in Canada?
In terms of years, yes.
For certainly the elementary and high school.
Yes, absolutely. That's right. Yep. Uh-huh.
Now, did your schooling encourage your interest in logical structures, or did it get in the way?
So, I think this was actually where my mother was an influence, because she was very serious about sort of making sure that both her kids had access to good school or school that was appropriate to them. And very early on, I think this was even in Ohio, I went to a Montessori school, for example, because this was her kind of influence to sort of have me being able to be in a place where I can think broadly, be challenged intellectually, and so on. And so I think my school, so my parents made a really big effort to make sure I was in good school and challenging programs. And so in the early, in sort of elementary days, I would say to some degree, yes. But also, I was, you know, as you start to go to grade 7, 8, middle school, high school, as I said, I'm not a mathematician. I wouldn't consider myself a mathematician. And as we all know, there's a very long tail in terms of mathematical talent. And so even by that time, I could see I was being swamped by some extraordinarily talented kids, you know. And so that was something that I liked doing, but it wasn't where I put all my effort in school, and I wasn't the kid sort of excelling in the math Olympiad. And so on.
So what were your interests?
I had a lot of different interests. So, I probably, in those days, English was probably my main interest, and I thought I would really get into writing. And that evolved into wanting to do something that really could make use of these problem-solving skills in a way that I didn't think English would allow me to. The reason I studied, so I studied econ as an undergrad, but I did a lot of mathematics, and part of the reason for doing mathematics, in my mind, aside from the fact that I saw its value and all the reasons that I already explained to you, is I felt like it was really, really hard, and it was something that would challenge me. And it's not that English and fiction writing isn't hard. It is, and it's really challenging, but I did feel like that was something where I would probably have a better chance of pushing myself, whereas if I had sort of left math to my own instruction, probably I wouldn't push myself as far. So that was one of the reasons for sort of doing as much technical work as I could as an undergrad and then in grad school and really pushing myself in mathematics. It was the most challenging thing I could think of.
Were you already thinking in terms of a career by then, or did that?
Yeah, so as an undergrad, I sort of always kind of...
Were you an undergrad at Stanford also?
I went to University of Ottawa.
Oh, University of Ottawa,
yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
I know University of Ottawa, but in the context of music.
Oh, okay, interesting, yeah. So that is where I started to push myself in terms of math, where I thought there were gaps in my knowledge and I wanted to sort of push them, and this was going to be extraordinarily useful. I didn't realize how useful. It turned out to be even more useful than what I imagined, actually, with all the, especially big data explosion and quantification of so much of our regular sort of thinking across society.
So, going from University of Ottawa, then it was to Stanford?
I did a master's degree at University of British Columbia in economics, and even as an undergrad, I was always interested in scholarship. I would sit in the library. They had the journals would be out on shelves and displayed all the latest editions and so on. I remember just browsing through them as an undergrad, which isn't as normal to do today because everything's online and so on. But I remember reading Karl Popper when just stumbling across this in journals and reading about this and being fascinated. So I think I've always had that interest in how do we construct knowledge? What's knowledge we can trust? How do we know what to believe or base our decisions on? And so that's sort of always, I think, kind of been there. So I kind of had this sense that I wanted to be a scholar and that's really where I belonged. And so doing the master's degree in economics, it's very normal in Canada. You would do a master's degree, then a PhD, so it's different to the U.S. But I assumed I would do this in economics. And what happened is I was at Stanford by that point, and I talked to some professors in the economics department at Stanford, thinking perhaps I would think about doing a PhD there, and I discovered two things. One, the questions I was most interested in seem to be the empirical questions, less than sort of either the theoretical questions or the purely mathematical questions. And much of the empirical work that I could see that was being done in econ department, they used econometrics, and this was sort of very in-house what they were doing in terms of their data analytics. And I was interested in things happening in computer science and pattern recognition and statistics and so on. And I thought if I really wanted to to work with data and do inference, why don't I get the biggest toolkit I can? And so that was the reason for doing the PhD in statistics rather than, say, continuing on with economics. And I think that, who knows, but I'm going to guess that the type of mathematics in the stats PhD, it sort of pushed me probably, you know, to my maximum capacity in stats. I mean, in math.
And it seems Stanford is a really good place for just that.
It's the top school, yeah.
Yeah. Who was your advisor?
David Donohoe. So that's someone who is, as far as I can tell, as well respected in the mathematical community as well as in the statistics community.
So what caught your interest specifically in statistics that led to a thesis.
Oh, okay, so that's interesting. So I was very lucky to work with my advisor, David Donahoe. I was a master's student, actually, in the statistics program at Stanford before I was a PhD student. Part of that, actually, was I needed a deeper mathematical grounding than what I was getting coming from economics. And I remember asking the department secretary if there was anyone who needed an RA. I'd been an RA as an undergrad, mm-hmm. and I knew I did a good job at this and could do it. And she said to me, you know, go talk to David Donahoe, and he's got a lot of grants, basically. And so I didn't know who these people were, and I went and knocked on his door, and that was one of the sort of the luckiest things that's ever happened in my life, in the sense that he did need an RA, and I ended up working with him for years, and that was really how I started working with him as an advisor. Now, his background is very different to mine. He wasn't someone, say, with an econ undergrad or interested in policy issues or, you know, sort of regulatory issues or, you know, social welfare theory, for example, like I was. However, he was, he is one of the best scientific thinkers I've ever met. And so being able to sort of apprentice to the way that he thought about scientific problems and scientific reasoning was extraordinarily useful. But what I wanted to do, so what we worked really hard actually to find a thesis that that sort of satisfied my interests in more econ, more policy type of work, and yet also, you know, was something where we could extend his work as well. So my thesis ended up being on model selection, particularly in regression problems when you have many more variables than you have observations. And so regression is something that's widely used in economics. So this was something I had a deep intuition around. But looking at these very high-dimensional mathematical problems, David had been doing for a while. And mm-hmm. so this was something where we were able to build on kind of my interests and, mm-hmm. and work that he'd been developing and come up with, you know, what I thought was great, at least an enjoyable thesis. Right. So
in graduate school, there's the research side, but there's also some teaching and so on. Did you get into that?
Yeah, lots of teaching.
Did you enjoy that?
So I was very lucky, actually. So one of the things that I did before I started at Stanford is I was an RA on mm-hmm. the Stanford campus for a couple of years in the National Bureau of Economic Research, and so working with economics professors for a couple of years, which is how I got to know people in the mm-hmm. econ department when I first got to Stanford. And what was your question again? Sorry.
Oh, it was on teaching.
Oh, right. That's
research.
That's right. So what I did at the NBER is we worked on Sun workstations, and mm-hmm. so I had to learn Unix, and I had to learn SAS, and I had to learn like all this mm-hmm. Computational infrastructure in order to do the work that we were doing on very large Medicare datasets, and. There's most stats departments have a very vibrant master's program, like people who want to obtain sort of quantitative skills. They're maybe not as interested in doing 4 or 5 years of sort of deep research and extending the research, but they want to get out in industry and apply this stuff and do data mining and whatnot. Many of the jobs that these master's students would go for asked for SAS. This is not a research language. You wouldn't mm-hmm. see... professors or professionals doing research in statistics and implementing their methods, they wouldn't implement it in SAS. They mm-hmm. would implement it in R or maybe Python, something like this. And so I was one of the only people who actually knew SAS. So I was, you know, happy to teach this at the master's level. Mm-hmm. So I actually was lucky enough to be able to design a course of my own mm-hmm. and be able to start teaching this mm-hmm. at Stanford. And I've some flavor or another of that SAS class has followed me around for years. So I've done quite a lot of teaching. I mean, more than that class, but that's been a gap I've been able to fill in a number mm-hmm. of stats departments mm-hmm. because, the professors, sort of when you do your academic training, you don't mm-hmm. get trained in SAS, for example. Yeah, so teaching I've been doing for quite a long time.
Uh-huh. So, you have your PhD from mm-hmm. Stanford. What was next?
Well, I got a law degree at Stanford.
Oh,
that was right after my PhD.
Ah, because I didn't see that in the or I missed it somehow in the write-up.
Yeah.
So why?
Well, so I'm all set up to answer that question quickly, actually. Mm-hmm. So given all my interest in policy, economics, and so on, and then working in the stat department, the with no regrets, pulled me away from those mm-hmm. interests a little bit. I saw law school as a way to knit them all back together.
Ah.
So law and econ is an established domain within law,
mm-hmm.
and they have all the philosophical issues and all these other quantitative issues and all these interesting issues here. I had done some consulting with a couple of law profs at Stanford just over the course of my PhD
mm-hmm.
and had remained friends with them, and
mm-hmm.
they were telling me things like, we've got lots of empirical stuff going on here. It would be great to have, you know, a bona fide statistician in the mix
mm-hmm.
where we can, you know, really kind of push on
mm-hmm.
some of these methods so there's opportunities. And it just sounded like an interesting way to do scholarship that would be able to bring those, all my
mm-hmm.
skills and interests back together.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I was right about that. That was the idea going
right.
in. Turns out law school is a professional school.
Yes.
They're training
yes.
lawyers. And
yes.
it's different to, say, the stat department where they're so research focused,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they're so
yeah.
academic. And so, but it was, you know, it was a great experience. And one of the things you'll see in the talk actually later tonight is the law training, particularly in intellectual property, has sort of opened up avenues of research for me around how, when you're sharing code and sharing data, how do you make them usable and available on the
mm-hmm.
web, and how do you, one of the things you
mm-hmm.
need to untangle are these legal issues
yes.
around licensing. And so that's something where there's a number of dimensions to reproducibility, and that's one, and I don't think there's any reason for scientists to be thinking about all these sort of legal problems. You know, so I worked some of them out and put some solutions out
mm-hmm.
there, and I've tried to make some arguments on why scientists should think that this
mm-hmm.
is a good way to do it, and so the idea was, let's make our the way we share work on the web match our scientific norms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm probably jumping several steps, but you're now listed in the information sciences,
right?
And sort of a library type position.
Right, right. That's right.
So what is the evolution toward that?
So okay, I'm going to back up a little bit. So
okay.
if you think about, so I mentioned how reproducibility has a number of dimensions in it. So part of my thesis was, so there are basically two components to my thesis, and one of them was how well do our current algorithms that we use and strategies around model selection and these very high dimensional problems, how well do they work? And so that's one of the things that I assessed in my thesis. Another thing that I did is built a platform that would house work around that area, not just my work, but other papers
mm-hmm.
and other research that was just starting to come together in this same kind of, it's really what we're trying to do is sparse modeling in very high dimensional
mm-hmm.
spaces. And there was work that was just sort of burgeoning around there. Mine was some of it, and there are many other people too. And so this platform was called Sparse Lab, and the idea was we would include the papers in there to start sort of building a community around
mm-hmm.
this research. But we wouldn't just include any papers. The papers would have the scripts associated with them
mm-hmm.
and any data associated with them that were required to reproduce the figures in the papers. And they had, most of the work was done in MATLAB, and so they had a MATLAB GUI where you would be able to, like associated with each paper, where you'd be able to say, okay, click on like figure 4 and then slide this parameter. How does it change if I, you know, have the input parameter move from
mm-hmm.
0.2 to 0.3 or whatnot. And so you really can kind of see interactively what's going on in that paper and what's going on in those discoveries and those algorithms.
Mm-hmm.
And so so I released Sparse Lab in around 2005 or 2006, and that was sort of the beginning of the thinking about reproducibility as something that was not just an important problem, but a potential career path.
Mm-hmm.
And my advisor made all of us work reproducibly in the sense of you could get the scripts, you could get the data, you would be able to regenerate figures that we were publishing
mm-hmm.
at the time of publication. And so I started thinking, well, you know, with the work that I've been doing in law school, I can start thinking about intellectual property issues around reproducibility and other issues around reproducibility. And it just seemed like a fascinating and rich area
mm-hmm.
to start doing research. And the problem is with that is it's a brand new area, brand new field to be researching in. It's not clear you can place this in sort of top field domain journals, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a sort of new type of
mm-hmm.
work in a way. And of course, every junior researcher knows that that's your sort of your ticket to sort of job stability is publishing in the sort of field's top journals, right? And if you're not going to do that, you're going to struggle, basically. Yes. And so I struggled. And so I had a, right out of law school, I did a one-year fellowship at Harvard Law School, sort of developing my thinking around the IP issues around reproducibility and access to code and data. And then another year at Yale Law School, similarly extending work, and we built lots of recommendations actually there around what to do around this reproducibility issue. And even then, and that was, I guess, around 2009, I guess, there was a lot of activity among scientists around this issue. This was something that was really concerning to people, especially in computational science. So how do you really verify published science when you're not able to dig into code or data, and you are often constrained to four or six pages in your paper and a short method section, and it's very difficult to unpack what people have done, let alone check what they've done. And so there was, even then, there was starting to be lots of sort of very heated activity in how do we start solving these problems from very senior people. Actually, this wasn't, you know, this was all across the board. Mm-hmm. But so there were a few voices then. And then I got a job at Columbia in the statistics department, and that was not a tenure track position. Mm-hmm. However, it gave me the space to, it was everything but tenure, and it gave me the space to really push on this research agenda, or, you know, change it if I wanted, but that was where I started to sort of really flesh out the different aspects to this problem. And one of them, particularly around access to code, access to data, how do you link this with the publication, and how do you enable reuse, for example, this is something that sort of information school folks also saw as part of something that they would consider as part of, not just part of their domain, but also where their domain is extending as the type of research that we do becomes more computational. Mm-hmm. So in hindsight, it shouldn't have surprised me, but it was surprising and lovely that these people were interested in my work, and so that's how this position at Illinois actually came about, and sort of this shift came about. And I see many of these fields doing overlapping research and many opportunities for interdisciplinary work and collaboration. So to me, it's there's sort of material differences and so on in a change like that, but the work is the same, and the very interdisciplinary nature of the work is the same. So it's still sort of feet in all the same camps.
So when you're talking about reproducibility, I mean, it's sort of the same as replicability in the sense that if you did the same experiment again, it would come out with similar results. But another one is looking at a paper and just being able to recreate what the results of the paper are without necessarily having all the pieces there.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So that's the right way to start thinking about reproducibility. So there are these different levels, and sometimes in talks I get this question, who cares if we can hit return and get the same figure? Like, I have your code, I have your scripts, say your MATLAB scripts, and I have your data, and I can get the same figure. That's not a contribution to science. What's the contribution is, I don't have your code and your data, and I re-implement your experiment independently from scratch, and then I get the same result, and then, you know, that's a contribution, and I've bolstered those results, and that's and that's right in some sense, but here's where that falls apart. The independent re-implementation, you're never going to get the same results, exact same results. So thinking as a statistician, the first thing I would think about is, well, what kind of noise do we expect in the process? Are there tolerance bounds that we would consider legitimate, or confidence intervals that allow us to understand when we would consider results the same, or in some sense, or that they've deviated enough that now that they're not the same? And that's very blurry, right? We don't have that sorted out. So that's so what we'll need to do is actually start reconciling how the independent implementation that I've done of your methods differs from your methods. Yes. It's somehow not the same. It could be different in the data sampling mechanism. It could be differences in implementation of the inference methods. It could be any number of differences. Something we didn't think about, or something in the machine. It could be any. And so we need that step-by-step ability to sort of hit return and regenerate your results so we can reconcile where they're actually different. So we need both. And it's true that hitting return doesn't advance science in some sense, but it opens a door to the advancement of science.
Now, it seems to me that it's always been an issue in experimental science anyway. What's interesting, what you're saying, is that it's also an issue in computational science.
Yeah. So it's interesting. So sometimes a question that I get is, why do you want the standards to be so much higher for computational science? Like, I mean, we just did a description in our empirical work, like our psychology experiment or whatever it is. We would just sort of write it out, and people would just have to, you know, implement it from that. And you were supposed to write your method section well, and it was supposed to be reproducible. Can't you just do that on a computer?
Right.
So there's two things about that. So one is, it's enormously complex. It's so easy to ask computers to do a million trillion tiny little things that are part of your experiment, and very difficult to report all of those in the methods section. It's just an order of magnitude, many orders of magnitude different than, say, describing an experiment in a lab or a survey that you've done or whatnot, which are both very complicated. But what we can do in terms of computation is just extraordinarily complex. You're not going to get all the details in a paper, period. And then, why should we be beholden to the standards that arose under empirical experimentation?
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't we rethink the standards for computation? I mean, computers track things so much more easily. It seems like, in a sense, it should be easier to share more of these details in a usable, executable way than it is for sort of empirical experiment, physical experiment-based science.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know why you would necessarily want to import those standards from a different type of experiment over to computer computational research. You would actually want to think of something appropriate for computational research, which is, that's really, in a sense, the core of my research.
Just on, I guess, on a sidelight, I mean, when I've encountered that way back when I was writing about these things, one was on floating point arithmetic and the fact that it doesn't quite do what you want
it to do.
That's
exactly
right. Because it's been implemented poorly.
That's right.
Or incorrectly or quirkily.
Or you don't know how it's been implemented
and
you just went and blazed ahead and did something or another. Right.
And the other one, which I've always loved writing about, random number generators.
Yep, absolutely.
Which are not really random number generators.
Absolutely. Right. So those are two
Some classic cases of when those have given you opposite results if you just change the generator.
That's right, and they're fascinating. Another example in that family is you're using a sort of a big computational system and you have systematic core failures, for example, and this can also affect your results and make them less stable. So there's a couple of things that I'm working on. So one is, that are related to this, so one is a shift to thinking about the computer as an experimental instrument, the same way we would think about, you know, a Bunsen burner or whatever it is, or a genome sequencing machine or whatever it is. And then doing that allows us to think about what errors and uncertainties are introduced into the research process from the computer as a tool. And some areas do this. There are some parts of scientific computing that basically just study this. But by and large, when a computer is used in scientific research, it's thought to be this perfect machine. Like this sort of returns perfect results, and we never think twice about it. And so I think as you know, the computer is now ubiquitous and becoming central to scientific research, we need to rethink and reassess that and really sort of understand how it interacts and introduces its own uncertainties in the process.
And even in mathematics, although it's more on the logic side, proofs that are done using a computer, are they, do you need a generator?
Absolutely. So this also raises this other interesting question that I'm fascinated with. So so the idea of a lot of empirical research is, I did something so you could understand it. Right? I would go through and I'd do the survey and you would see the process. You'd go, okay, that makes sense for a survey. I can understand her results and so on. For much of the computational proofs, you start to lose that cognitive thread, right? Like you, in a sense, you believe the setup of the problem, you believe the computational implementation, so you start to believe the output, but it isn't really something, or maybe it is, maybe I'm still thinking about this, but it may not be something that is deductive logic for our minds anymore. And so what does that departure mean for mathematical discovery? And I can, you know, I can show you on a computer that it works over some range, right? But what does that really mean for mathematics? It's really interesting.
I could keep on asking all kinds of questions here because it's something that interests me in a variety of ways for a variety of reasons. But just to skip ahead, if you were then now thinking, say, 5 or 10 years ahead, where would you like to be?
Oh gosh. So, I think probably I would be doing exactly the same thing. hopefully my research has advanced a bit. Mm-hmm. Hopefully. Right. But I don't really see myself doing anything differently. I might like to take some of these ideas and unpack them into books and make mm-hmm. them more accessible than what you mm-hmm. might see in a journal article. Mm-hmm. But that would be the only sort of, I think, fundamental change. I just want to push on problems that I think are interesting mm-hmm. and relevant. And I can imagine getting to the... I take it for granted I'll get to the end of my life and this mm-hmm. these problems won't be solved.
Yeah. Now, your bio says that you have testified before Congress
right.
and done various things. How did that come about?
I don't know how that came mm-hmm. about. I just got a phone call or uh-huh. an email or something. I don't really know what the backroom discussions were.
Oh, okay.
But that's right, so...
But what were you there to explain to them?
Well, okay, so that I had a little bit of clarity on. It's still who knows, really, mm-hmm. what was going on. So this was the House Science, Space, and Technology, or mm-hmm. Science, Technology, and Space.
Yeah.
Ooh, I forget which one. Yeah. So that committee, and they have a subcommittee on research integrity. And so one of the things that I'm sure you've seen over the last couple of years, and I'm going to mention it in the talk later, is people are pretty excited about this idea that we're producing or even funding with the federal money research is not reproducible.
Mm-hmm.
And so they draw these conclusions, it's not good science.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in fact, what are we even doing with this? Reproducibility is a cornerstone. So there's lots to unpack in that statement, but I think that was the genesis of this...
Mm-hmm.
This committee. So there were four of us. Bruce Alberts was there, who from at the time he was just finishing his tenure at Science Magazine, and I was there, and two other folks that I'll need to don't quote me. I need to look up their names.
Mm-hmm.
Shoduri was there from John Hopkins, and I know the other guy really well. I'm just blanking on his name. And so the committee was basically asking us, well, what's this whole deal about reproducibility? Like, how do we apply this to federal
mm-hmm.
funds? How do we think about the science that's coming out, and so on?
Mm-hmm.
And I was actually really impressed by most of the questions of
mm-hmm.
the committee members.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, you had folks in there who had backgrounds in, say, medicine or
mm-hmm.
interest in science, and
right.
Actually had pretty smart questions
mm-hmm.
and concerns about how do we verify this stuff, particularly
mm-hmm.
when it's computational.
Now, clearly, you've been paying attention to communicating all this. This isn't just research, but
I'm
also
trying
to get all this across.
Yeah, trying. Well, I see it all as part of the same
mm-hmm.
thing,
yeah.
Which also explains why I struggle with my career. But that's neither here nor there.
But it sounds like it sounds interesting and fun, and
that's what's important to me, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I'm still getting a paycheck. I'm still alive, so
mm-hmm.
that's really all that matters. And
mm-hmm.
And things keep advancing. I mean, I've seen this issue go from something where I was giving talks 2 or 3 years ago, and people would just be confused in the audience, or
mm-hmm.
they'd be like think I was, I don't know, making things
mm-hmm.
up or something. And then at some or saying things that were so outlandish and impossible or something,
mm-hmm.
and then at some point around 18 months ago, it just really changed. Like
mm-hmm.
the reactions in the talks would be like, yeah, I know all that, but what do I do?
Yes.
How do I fix this?
Uh-huh.
I didn't need to present the problem anymore.
Yes.
What I needed to do was just sort of frame things in ways that help them advance towards solutions, and
mm-hmm.
then talk about what the solutions might be and what's
mm-hmm.
out there and what people are coming up with and
mm-hmm.
what can we do about this.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a real big step. Like
mm-hmm.
somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Some phase transition happened there,
uh-huh.
yeah. And so things have just been, and then things have just been on this sort of upwards trend
uh-huh.
on that
uh-huh.
after that. So
sounds exciting too.
Yeah, it's been good actually. Yeah. So there's no shortage of interesting problems to work on. That
yeah.
is true. The downfall in this topic has been all in the stuff of how do you integrate it into traditional academia, which is very important. It's very important for students. It's very important
mm-hmm.
for, the survival of important topics. So that's been the biggest struggle,
mm-hmm.
actually, in this. But I think this is getting resolved.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Yeah, it's becoming a more
yeah.
well-known place to do research and recognized
mm-hmm.
as important.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you.